Mr. Boyne, Reel 3. We were talking about your training with the 60th Training Regiment at Catterick Camp, early 43. And we're talking about these firing from a point two two from a turret thing. How did the turret go round? I mean, how did you actually make it go left and right?
Just mechanically geared in my hand. And I think this thing had an old name. If they could actually tilt it as if the turret was moving, as if it was its fictional vehicle that was rolling over an uneven terrain. So you had this sort of wallowing sort of pitch to it to try and keep it on course to fire this little 2-2. It was a crude sort of thing, really, I guess. But
did it help? I mean, was it any use compared to the real thing?
No, not really. It's another dimension of the thing. It was a stepping stone, I suppose. But you didn't spend a great deal of time in that. But I can remember it from Riper or something like that. Rolling, yawning, pitching next. That's it, Riper. Rolling, yawning, pitching action.
RYPA.
Yeah.
And we're talking about gunnery. What else did they use to do, you know, to train you?
We didn't do a massive amount of gunnery, in truth, at that point. We used to do the turret practicing where you were loading, pretend firing, as it were. But these were in a Valentine, small 2-pounder sort of. They were like tiny little shots. You practice that with the misfire sort of sequence where they would load the shell and it would go through the misfire where you had to leave it. You'd fire it, it wouldn't go, you'd have to leave it for 1 minute and then open the breech and sort of rub it out.
What was the. So it's a one man drill, isn't it? Obviously, you know. Yeah. So what was the turret 2-pounder gun drill? Where would the shells be for a start?
Oh, they were stacked around the edge, similar to a Sherman, standing upright around the turret. Edge.
Strapped in?
Yeah. And you could unmatch them.
Did you have to fuse them?
No.
So, what would you do?
Over the breech, stand on it, punch it in. I think on that one, the breech came from underneath, so when you punched it, you went up. And likewise, when the other breech on the Sherman came across,
I'll come back to the Sherman. Yeah.
The other way. So your hand went away from it, travelling front.
And the firing mechanism?
Well, that was obviously didn't work, but you just went through the motions of.
Was it a trigger or a?
The trigger on that one. Yeah.
And how did you aim it in the 2-pounder in the turret? I mean,
it was just on the handle. You could raise or lower the action, or turn it left or right on another one. It was very cool, really, I guess.
Did they do any technical training on gunnery, you know, elevation and distance and all the rest of it, the mathematics of gunnery at all, or was it really just to point and shoot?
That's about the sum total of it, I guess. I didn't enlarge very much on it, I guess. A lot of the time we spent doing a bit of engine work.
Sticking to gunnery, were you introduced? I know you were going to be a turret gunner, but did they introduce you to the Browning, which was usually the standard hull gun?
That was for the Sherman. That was.
Or what was the Valentine's?
The Valentine or the Beaver or something like that. It wasn't the American Browning.
And did they introduce you to that?
They showed them to us rather than hands on, I guess. I don't think they had much in the way of Brownings. I think we saw them, but it wasn't until later that I spent dismantling those and rebuilding them.
But not to that stage.
But not at that stage.
So, anything else about gunnery before we move on?
Well, there wasn't a great deal. Yeah, I mean, obviously you stripped out the beach block and the thing is for the shut in the beach, and they take them out, oil them up, and put them back, and dismantle that. You practice that fair bit of the time, but some of that could be done in the huts or mops, really. But the 13 weeks certainly went by.
The mechanical stuff you did, what was that? Because you were going to be a gunner mechanic.
They went through the basic mechanics of vehicles, cars, bottom gearbox, you know, clutch gearbox. And they had old vehicles there that you could actually take the gearbox off and put back. A chassis engine gearbox and wheels. So you could play, I suppose, really.
They weren't training you as a fitter, were they?
No.
That's much more deep.
Just pure mechanical basics.
So you wouldn't do any of the fitter's trade tests, like, you know, filing a piece of metal to a certain shape?
No, we didn't need that.
So it was just introduction to...
Just mechanics.
Did that interest you?
I enjoyed that. Yeah, I did enjoy that.
Now the wireless, they introduced you to that as well. How did it go about that?
General sort of lecture on it. It's working, it's procedures. Spent a bit of time on the wireless procedure. You know.
What was that?
And you open up how you converse, how you shut down, over and outs, and the Ivan Baker Charlie sort of alphabet that goes with it.
What about Morse code, things like that?
Well, yes, the actual wireless operators did that. We all did it. But the wireless operators had to achieve a certain standard. We all went through it, but if you didn't achieve the standard, it didn't matter that much. But it was mostly for them. They had to achieve a certain standard, and they're testing where they had to pick up a message that was sent over. Although it went to us all, but I mean, half of us didn't care whether you learned it or not.
And that was you as well?
That was me as well, yeah. I wasn't particularly bothered about it. Although you still remember of bits of it, you know.
Now, driving training, was that track, wheels and track?
Yeah, we started on wheels, 1500 weights, and they used to take you out. And that I enjoyed. I really did enjoy that. There'd be a couple of them with a driver. You leave the base, and then you take it in turns to drive, and swanning about the Yorkshire Dales and the like.
Could you drive before?
No, not really. No, we ride a motorbike, but I couldn't drive. But I really did enjoy that. I used to look forward to that.
Any trouble? I mean, to us, it's a nightmare, double declutching, all the rest of it. Did you have trouble with it, or was it?
No, it was there, you got into it, you know. But driving was a joy, that one for me.
Did you pass a test or qualify?
Yes.
And was it just the 1500 weights you learned?
No, we had three tonners. And you drive about, and then tomorrow you'd be on a bigger vehicle or a smaller vehicle. And I had little bass boxes, they called them. They were these little Austin. And they had radio sets in the back. There was one signals that you drive, take them out, you drive out with a wireless operator in the back, and that was to give them sort of a training. And a signals officer would give you different places to go and look for the numbers for map reference. This was part of map reading as well. And of course, the usual wags that got there first would have them out and alter them, you know. so that you'd finish up with a grotesque set of numbers which would lead you off a mile from where you should be. And when you come to sort of, while it's not right, come to sort of singing where you were, you're so way off because it wasn't true. And the signals officer used to really get rattled about that, that's for sure. But you always get the wags performing.
What about tracked vehicles? What did they start you on?
A Valentine.
They did not Bren carrier then?
No, I never drove, but they never had them. They were just Valentines there.
And what were the Valentine like to drive?
They're just strange, really. They had a weird setup. The driver's pocket was at the back, and it had a drum. That's because that's what did the braking for turning. And this drum used to turn at about, I don't know, six times the rate of the sprocket. So the drum would be spinning inside the sprocket, and that's the brakes were in there, in as much that when you wanted to turn right, you pulled the right stick, and that put the brake on that side, and you went round, of course. But it was also serrated, this thing, and if you got sort of bogged down, you could put a rope around this drum and pull yourself out. In fact, on a half standing, they said that if you get hold of this drum and you could turn it enough, you would move the vehicle. And of course, everybody used to try it. And sure enough, it would move. But I mean, a lot of effort for moving it 1 inch was what was required. So the novelty of that soon wore off. But we used to lose the tracks out on the hills when you were out driving. The tracks used to come off. And then, what a performance that used to be. It was always buried under about 6 inches of mud. So you had to go and dig it to find it. Having found it, the pins used to come out. So then you had to get the two loose ends and stick them on the sprocket and pull them together. It's like a bicycle chain, really, on a grand scale. But all the instruments had great long shafts to sort of pull the eccentric up once it was on, sledgehammers, shovels. It was real sort of exercise, that was digging out of those out, and they used to pop up quite regularly.
And what about the actual controls when you were driving? I mean, was it just a one driver, or did you have gearsmen in the Valentine? You didn't have.
No, just the one, and just had a gearbox, clutch as well.
And was it
stick?
One stick.
Two sticks. One for the left, one for the right.
So no wheel of any sort.
Just all random sticks.
And did you get the hang of it?
Yeah. And the harder you pull, the harder it turns, as it were.
And what was the view like from the driving position?
Not good.
Could you stick your head out like in a Sherman?
No, not on the Valentine, you couldn't. No, you just look it through the little window in the front.
A sort of slit.
Yeah, so your vision was very limited. That's why people used to hit walls and run into a ditch. And they took it out one night, I remember, on a night run. Well, you know, daylight's one thing, but night is something else. Of course, there's no lights. And there were two of us to drive it. And I'd had my go. So I then got up in the turret and tucked myself down in there. And the commander, he tucked himself down as well. And we were running along and we could hear this funny noise. And looking out the turret, we were ploughing up a wall. The rocks had come bouncing off the side of this thing where the chap missed the road and was running up against this wall with all the noise that went with it. I imagine a lot must have done this. It was quite easily done.
So that's the driving. So anything else about your training?
A lot of that was spent out driving, I guess. The gunnery was pretty sparse, really, to what was required. That didn't really get going until we moved on.
So you were there till about June. Early February to June. And again, were you tested at the end of it, or was it continuous assessment, as they call it now, again?
I suppose it was continuous assessment, but there was a sort of a test that you had to achieve certain standards. I can't even remember what they were at this point in time, but I mean, everybody, to my knowledge, went through.
And what was your next stage of your training or becoming a tank gunner?
Well, we had the passing out parade, and that's what this 13 weeks really finished up with. You then got leave, which up till then, that was your first one. So
what was the anything special about a passing out parade?
Not particularly. The usual. I mean, they even had a band out for leave. You really suffering when you've got a band out to sort of see you off. Either that or the gaps in the back of you, one or the other. But it was a pompous sort of affair. Nick with the old threat words, well, it's got to go off dead smooth, otherwise nobody goes on leave, you know, the usual. But it was good to get it done, and then you got a 7-day leave. And I think the wireless operators who passed the actual Morse, they got an extra 2 days stuck on the end of that. That was an incentive for us to sort of learn it, I guess. But passing out, I then went to a training regiment at the Farmer Castle.
And do you know what number it was?
No, I can't tell you that.
Was there only one? Because we can look it up. It's one training regiment.
I know exactly where it was. It was the one at the top of the hill just over the river. But
was that Westgate Camp?
Pardon?
Westgate Camp?
I couldn't tell you.
Barnard Castle, anyway.
Castle, yeah. And that, the idea there was, evidently, that you trained as a crew. Ideally, you went out as a crew. A driver, co-driver, gunner, wireless mech, laptop. So the training there was more or less coming together as a team.
And
it's team training.
And what were you in? Would you all practice to do every job at this stage, or would you be now...
This is where they started to sort of specialise, I suppose. And certainly did a lot more gunnery there with them.
And what tanks were you using?
Shermans, yeah. Yes, Shermans. And we went as a team... The wireless loader, you know, operating the gunner and the drive. It was like pulling the thing together, and then at the end of the day, that's how you would be pushed out to a unit as a proper crew. Whether that always took place or not, I wouldn't have to say, but that was the thought. That's where you had small arms firing.
Well, let's look at the sticking with the tank. What were the this was your introduction to the Sherman then.
Yeah.
Could you just describe as much as you can about the Sherman and about how the crew fitted into it and generally? What about the turret of the Sherman? Because that's what you were going to be. What was it like inside the turret?
Room-wise, of course, it was cramped. The gun sighting was through the periscope. The site was built into the telescope. So you had that bang in front of you, the gun was to the side. And the ammunition was arranged around the turret, standing up, basically. And you had armour piercing and a high explosive. The high explosive, you had a time delay on it. That you could, with a screwdriver, move it crossway and that would give it a fraction delay so you could fire through a brick wall and then it would slow the other side. The wireless operator was the other side, the 19 set was behind on the shelf at the back. That's it. The wireless operator then had access to the breech on that side. What else did he do? What? Kamala was behind the gunner, but he'd be up slightly higher, although he did have a seat that he could drop down and get down low if he wanted to, but most of them kept their head out.
And what about the gun? The gun was a
75mm.
And what did you think of that?
Well, when I first saw it, I thought it was wonderful, you know. I mean, when you see that against the two-pounder, I mean, it was like looking at a pop down here, I mean, to something with some real substance in it. Yeah, it looked good. And that had the Browning machine guns on the side of it, and the co-drive had the Browning.
So you just had the 75mm in the turret?
Yeah, the Browning as well.
Alongside it. So looking at the 75mm, what was was there any difference in the breech mechanism or the loading between? Would the wireless? You said he had access to the breech. Would he help you or?
No, he'd do that. He'd load because the breech would be his side, as it were. He would load it, and when the breech shut, then you give your commander would then give you the target, the range. You set the sights on it.
So you would move the turret round?
You'd move the turret.
And was that, how was that moved round on the Sherman?
Mechanically.
So what would you do?
The handle, wind it round.
Just turn a handle?
Yeah. And then the elevator was also on a handle.
Were they hydraulically assisted? Or?
There were some. Yes, there were some. Yeah, you could move them. Yes, some had them. But generally, it was just mechanical. And the commander had a vane up on the turret, and would be lined up with the gun would be lined up with that virtually. So he could get the turret moved so that his sight would be on the house or whatever you were going to aim at, and then your gun wouldn't be far off of that. But fine tuning would be done from you.
And he'd give the order to fire, would he, or would you just fire when it came into view?
Either fire when ready, or you know, hold and then fire when.
So it could be either way.
But normally fire when ready, when things really got warmed up, you would have to sort of bang them off.
And the Browning, what about that?
That was the .30 Browning. You'd have a. A belt of ammo that was in a box, the ammunition box, that would be threaded through, and then the gun would be cocked, and then you could fire that from your control on your side of the wall. And the loader then would put in a new belt when required.
So he'd do that again?
Yes, every time the belt ran out, he'd stick a new one in.
So did it just fire straight, that one, or could you move that round?
No, that moved the turret.
So just wherever it was pointing, it pointed?
When you moved the turret, that gun went with it,
What about up and down?
Yeah, that would move with the main gun. They worked in unison, you see.
Right.
So we aim one way to care. The Browning had, unlike some, it always left the round in the barrel. The next fresh round was always in the barrel, and later, when you used it a lot, you put a few belts through, the barrels got very hot, so the round in there would get hotter and hotter, and they would probably go, you used the fire on their own. And the way you had to overcome that was to pull the belt back. But for the co-driver, that was a bit dodgy, because he used to get out, he used to hang on to that to pull himself out. And to look down the barrel of a Browning that's got a lot round in it would be particularly funny. The thing with those two, that you could change the barrel of that from the inside. They were typical American, somebody thought of it, that you could actually pull. You carried replacement barrels as part of your normal spare. But you could change that from inside quite easy. And you add to it.
How would you do it?
You took the breech out, and there was a locking device. That once you undid that, you could then slide the barrel back out from its outer covering. It has sleeve over the outside for the holes for cooling. You can slide that out, put another one in, lock it, and stick the reach in that back. It didn't take long. Because if you fired a lot of arrows through quickly, it used to take all the rifling out, and then those shots would be all over the place. You lost all the accuracy.
Could you tell?
Oh, yeah, because when you saw the traces flying all over the shot, you knew well out.
That's when you do it. How many belts would it be?
Well, I think at one time in the Normandy stages, I think I fired at least 7 belts straight through it, and the last belt, I mean, was a danger to everybody. I mean, it was, they were flying it, you know, way out. The actual rifling had virtually gone.
So, anything else about the turret itself? There's the three. It always looks as if it would be incredibly crowded for 3 people to be in there.
It was, I suppose. You know, you couldn't move very much. There was nowhere to move to, if you know. The one that had the most room was the wireless op, I suppose. He had a third of the turret himself, you know, where the other third was taken up by a breach and the gun had its recoil. Then the gunner, and then with the commander right behind him, the other third.
Did you have to watch out for the recoil coming? I mean, could you get caught by it?
No, it had a shield on the back of it to stop you. In fact, on the later ones, the big 17-pounders that we had, the fireflies, that had like a fire shield that used to deflect the flame, because the barrel being so long, the flame was still in the barrel when the breech started opening. So when this empty case came out, it was followed by a flame that used to lit round. And in the summer heat, when you had nothing on your arms, you take the layers off your arms, you know.
Anything else about the turret? I mean, the view, all-round view, I mean, what was your view like?
From the gunner, you just had your, the sight in the viewfinder was all built in, and you just had the periscope sort of.
That was all you had?
That's all you had. Yeah.
Now, what
you
about
saw everything through that little window like that.
What about the 5x3?
Yeah,
6 inches by 3?
In that with the range on it as well. That was all in. So it was quite a small view.
Now, what about the rest of the tank? I mean, we've concentrated on the turret at the moment. The rest of the crew, you'd have the driver and the co-driver.
And with the gearbox between them. You have the big drive between them.
So the driver, was that also the two-stick method?
That's right, always the same.
And what other controls would they have?
No more down there. No, just the clutch. Throttle. You could raise and lower the seat. You could raise it to a high position where you had your head out. Or then you could drop it. And
then what would you look through?
Periscope.
Another periscope. And that would be a restricted...
Yeah, very much so.
And what about the co-driver? I'm not quite sure what the co-driver actually does in the Sherman. I'm not.
Well, he had the Browning down there as well. On the flight that he could control that, he could fly from that. And then he was take over from the driver on you know, runs, relief one or the other. But most of the time he spent with his Browning, yeah.
So, a machine gunner, more than anything else.
Yeah.
And any other crew in the main body?